Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, Ivy Bridge is shipping. Should you upgrade? SSD price wars, Velociraptor versus Momentus XT, and quite a bit more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 167, recorded April 26th, 2012. Ivy Bridge is here.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, and this is the show where you find out what's big and bad and new and exciting in the world of computer hardware. And, of course, we like to dip our toe into the world of tablets since they seem to be taking over computer programs. Joining me, as always, this time from the most unusual Texarkana, Arkansas. Unusual for Mr. Ryan Shrout, not for Texarkana. Mr. Ryan Shrout.
Now, Texarkana can be unusual, too. On the drive to Austin, Texas, stopping over here for the night. And it looks like Crossfingers Hotel Internet appears to be working. So you never know how long, though.
Cut to black.
Yeah, pretty much. But it's good because we had a lot of stuff happen in the hardware world. So,
well, 80% of what happened in the hardware world is probably, can we call this the official announcement or the actual genuine, not sneaked out numerical benchmark release of Intel's Core i7, the desktop Ivy Bridge processors?
That is correct. Actually, both desktop and mobile. But yes, so this is kind of the official unveiling. Actually, one of the things, just as a side note early on in the discussion, is these processors aren't for sale yet, which I was not under that assumption when we wrote the article. They'll be on sale on the 29th, so just a few days from when we record this. But we had several questions about it, and we actually had to go ask Intel because I didn't know the answer. And it turns out that they're not actually going to be on sale till the 29th. But yes, this is the kind of official unveiling of the desktop variant of Ivy Bridge, Intel's first 22 nanometer processor, quad core. I don't know, Patrick, how much of the architecture do we really want to go over? I know we've talked about it a lot in the past. The primary differences are on the GPU side, right? Not on the CPU side, right?
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think for most people out there, you know, if you've been waiting for Ivy Bridge to buy a new computer, good. Nothing wrong with that. Smart thing to do. Mm-hmm. We always tell you to wait to see where the price drops down. If you're looking for a gigantic boost in computing performance from Ivy Bridge compared to Sandy Bridge, you're not going to get it. Are you going to get sort of a longer length of life for the motherboard, or for the, more accurately, for the little, you know, the mount, the socket? Yes, you're going to get that from Ivy Bridge compared to Sandy Bridge. But like Ryan just said, the big differences are really on the GPU, the graphics side of the fence.
Now, so what is the same is that it is still a monolithic die. It still has CPU, x86 AI cores, and GPU, not cores, but execution units, their GPU portion, all on the same die. So this is a 22 nanometer GPU as well as CPU, which is always cool to see. It is the first processor to integrate PCI Express 3.0, although we've talked about here on the show that the need to go to PCI Express 3.0 is really not even there for any kind of graphics and stuff. There are a couple of other things. So I think maybe the most important thing to enthusiasts that has changed is with this move to 22 nanometer, we talk a lot in the article about power consumption. The general kind of rule that when we move down process nodes is that you assume we're going to get lower power consumption, lower temperatures, or you're going to get higher clock speeds out of it, right? You're going to use, instead of getting lower temperatures and lower clock speeds, rather than lower temperatures and that kind of stuff, you're going to apply that towards higher clock speeds. The 3770K, which is the flagship Ivy Bridge part that was released, is pretty much parity in terms of clock speeds with the Sandy Bridge 2700K. So we're not seeing big increases in clock speed here, maybe 100 megahertz here or there, depending on your turbo boost modes. But the main difference is in the TDP. So while the 2700K and 2600K processors, the most popular, I think, Sandy Bridge parts on the market today are 95-watt TDP parts, Ivy Bridge 3770K is actually 77 watts. So we're actually seeing a pretty dramatic drop down in your TDP, even running at the same clock speeds. And that's pretty impressive. Now, I think we'll talk about this a little bit when we discuss the mobile side, but that's maybe not as important for the desktop user as it is for the mobile user, that whole kind of drop in TDP for the same performance levels. But as a side to it, it's running at lower voltages. I think you're running at like 1.1 volts or so nominally, which is about, Sandy Bridge is like 1.3, something like that. If you look at our temperature testing when we did overclocking, these parts are getting hotter than Sandy Bridge did when you're overclocking. I want to make sure I make that case. It's only when you're overclocking and you're pushing that voltage above where it's supposed to be, where, you know, where Intel says it should be, we're seeing, you know, we hit almost 90 C in some of our really, really high-end overclocking, which is not great, right? And we're using a Corsair H80, you know, self-contained water cooler, which is basically one of the highest-end consumer-friendly coolers you can use for a processor, right? So that's a Go ahead.
I was going to say, I almost wonder if that's a big function of the 22-nanometer process where you've shrunk the die and you basically end up concentrating a ridiculous number of transistors in an even smaller space. You know what I mean? Like you just end up, you know, slightly, you know, more heat, smaller space that makes the thermal transfer off of the, you know, the chip to the cooler that much more difficult. To the, you know, this chip to the heat sink to the cooler, you know, the smaller the area you're pulling the heat through. It's like trying to pull a camel through the eye of a needle. It just gets that much harder.
that's definitely, I think, the biggest component of it. The other part is, you know, when these companies build process technologies, 45 nanometer, 32 nanometer, 90 nanometer, they really kind of target it towards specific use cases. If you look at a company like Global Foundries, where they have multiple process technologies, you'll notice that they had a 28 nanometer high performance and 28 nanometer low power. And the reason for that is you can tweak the silicon in a way so that it will run at higher clock speeds, but you're going to pay a little bit more on the power side. Or right. you can kind of, you know, perfect it for lower power but lower clock speeds. And what it seems obvious here that Intel did is they took their 22 nanometer process and tilted it towards that low power side. And as a result, when you add more voltage to overclock these cores, the temperatures are spiking and the leakage is high. And those are the results of kind of tweaking for low power, right? So it seems pretty obvious that they tweaked for the mobile side. They tweaked to get Ivy Bridge to as low voltage as possible. You know, we talked on our podcast last night about the ability to undervolt Ivy Bridge CPUs if you are really concerned about power consumption and heat and that kind of stuff. And these processors will likely be very, very good for that because of that process technology. Now, they're showing on the screen our power consumption numbers. And look at the idle power consumption on that, Patrick. That's with a GeForce GTX 560 Ti installed in the system. And we're idling at like, what is that, 57 watts, essentially. Right. And if you look at the load power consumption, Ivy Bridge is like 25, 30 watts less than Sandy Bridge and more than 100 watts less than Sandy Bridge E. So it's the 22 nanometer process is doing what Intel wants it to do. But I know there's going to be a lot of overclockers and kind of high-end enthusiasts that go with the mantra that Sandy Bridge is actually a better part because when you overclock it, it doesn't get as hot. It can take more voltage without sweating as much underneath its cooling and that kind of stuff. And that's it looks like that's going to be the case. If you're like an LN2 guy and you're just after frequency, maybe Sandy Bridge is still going to be the best part. We have a story we'll talk about later where ASUS got like 7 gigahertz on one of these. But Ivy Bridge is definitely targeted at low power, not super high overclocking voltages and that kind of stuff.
I'd be really curious, like, why do you think is this part of a greener move for Intel, or they're preparing for Energy Star certification for CPUs, or is it just, you know, in order to reduce the thermal envelope, they needed to reduce the power consumption? Do those two things kind of go hand in hand, you think?
Yeah, I really don't think it has anything to do with going green. It's more of the whole company's focus now is competing with ARM, competing with those guys. not necessarily with Ivy Bridge, but we want to make a more power efficient processor than we'd ever made before. And it really comes down to look at where the AMD Bulldozer architecture is in our performance benchmarks. They don't have any competition on the high end still, right? Not even in terms of performance per watt. So they don't really need to focus on getting more performance to compete with AMD. What they want to do is focus on perfecting their system to create incredibly energy efficient processors that can go in ultrabooks and then tablets and then phones, right? When we see Haswell in a couple of years, it's going to exist from desktop down to cell phones to a base degree, right? And so they're moving. They want to make one chip that can go across all of those fields, which is really, really hard to do. And so they have to pick a point where they want to focus on, and it seems like they focus on the low power. It's one of the cool things. If you look at the CPU lineup, they have a Core i7-3770T that still clocks as high as 3.7 gigahertz, which is just a couple hundred megahertz lower than the high-end part that we're looking at. It's still quad-core. It's still hyper-threaded, but it has a 45-watt TDP. So, you know, specifically Bend processors are hitting as low as 45 watts, still being able to perform just absolutely incredibly, and including 8 megs of cache and the new Intel HD 4000 graphics and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty impressive what they've been able to do, but it doesn't surprise me if there are going to be enthusiasts that aren't, you know, jumping up and down to go out and upgrade their Sandy Bridge systems.
I wanted a 30% performance increase. Now, that said, if you know, you may not be wanting to upgrade your Sandy Bridge machine, but if you're looking for a new machine, I think the Core i7, the PC Per is pretty adamant about this. The Core i7-3700K, $313. Not that much slower than the Core i7-3960X, which is a $1,000 part, sort of the last of the super high-end Sandy Bridge parts. You know, in terms of like, you know, how much are you giving up for, you know, you're saving $720. Are you giving up 20% performance, 10% performance between those two processors? Or is that even a fair comparison?
It's a fair comparison because you can buy the two. I mean, you can compare anything you want. You're going to see 20 to 30% performance difference because keep in mind that the Sandy Bridge E part you listed there is actually a 6-core processor, and the Ivy Bridge parts are quad core. So, you know, you're seeing a 50% theoretical core difference, but because of the clock speeds and the way the architectures work, you're not going to get 50% more performance in most of cases. There might be a couple of rare occasions. But it's, yeah, when it comes down to it, we're talking about $720 versus the performance difference you get. You know, you have to really know what you want, and you have to know that it's Sandy Bridge E with its 40 lanes of PCI Express and all that kind of stuff, that you definitely need that specific hardware. To validate that purchase. Now, one of the things we did include in our performance numbers and our power consumption numbers is the Core i7-920, which is a processor you are very familiar with.
Oh yes.
And funny you should mention that. One of the comments in there is, wow, I didn't realize how much additional power the Nehalem architecture used compared to Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge. We hadn't used a Core i7-920 in our results in a long time. And when we redid all of our testing, I just included that in there. I mean, the idle power consumption is like 120 watts with the i7-920 versus 55 watts. Now, that's a different motherboard, but it's you know, the same basic kind of platform otherwise, processor, memory and graphics card and power supply and all that kind of stuff. So that's pretty dramatic difference. I guess the only other thing we need to mention.
It may finally be time for me to upgrade my Core i7-920. Almost. Yeah.
almost. And at least, you know, you're not with, even if you get the highest in Ivy Bridge, you're paying $313. To me, it doesn't feel super expensive. I realize you can get $100 processors and $200 processors, but I'm used to seeing, you know, I've been in this for a long time. I'm used to seeing the $1,000 flagship be just worlds ahead of everything else. Right. And then seeing like the one you really want is like $500 or $600. So being able to get it for $315 when they go on sale is pretty nice. The HD 4000 graphics, I did want to mention this real quick. If you are a user interested in integrated graphics, processor graphics, whatever you want to call it, this is a pretty noticeable upgrade over Sandy Bridge. It's still not going to take away the discrete market, but the first result in our HD 4000 testing in the performance testing towards the end is 3D Mark Vantage, and it shows like a 80% performance boost, but that's not really accurate. The main difference here with this graphics subset is we've gone from 12 execution units to 16 execution units. So you're getting 33% additional compute power, and those execution units are tweaked a little bit. You've got additional vertex processing and back-end shader processing and that kind of stuff. So the table there that they're showing in the video kind of gives you a really good side-by-side of what the differences are. Plus, you have 3 monitor output support through Ivy Bridge alone, right? So if your motherboard is configured correctly, you can do 3 displays hooked up to your integrated graphics, which I think is pretty sweet as well. Performance-wise, you're talking 25-35%. It's going to be good enough. Like, we tested Dirt 3 at 1080p, low settings, and it was playable. Left 4 Dead 2, 1080p, very high settings, and it was playable. But, you know, even Deus Ex Human Revolution, which is not a very GPU-intensive game, we had to run at 16:10 low settings. And Battlefield 3, you know, you're going to have to play at low settings and that kind of stuff. But it works now. It's playable, and it's an advantage. It's more of an advantage for the mobile side. But it is there. And QuickSync sees performance improvements as well. I don't, did you ever use QuickSync, actually, other than kind of testing it, Patrick?
No. It's one of those things that, like, it sounded like a great idea, but never really came up much in use.
I have to admit, we've never really used it because the type of applications that it's been implemented in are not the applications I typically use. CyberLink, Media Espresso,
right.
Those types of things that are very kind of mom-pop centric and not enthusiast, prosumer centric. We had some weird problems with some Flash files not converting to MP4s correctly, and we found if we ran it through Media Espresso that it would play back fine for whatever reason. And the difference between running it on, we have a Nehalem-based system as our editing rig. I think it's a Core i7-975 or something like that, 6-core part, that ran it. I mean, it was 4 or 5 times slower than when we ran it on our Ivy Bridge testbed through QuickSync. It's interesting on there. And they're promoting that Adobe Photoshop CS6 is going to implement performance improvements for Intel's media architecture, their back-end architecture there, and quite a few other, you know, more prosumer-style applications. So that's going to be interesting down the road. I still don't know if this generation with Ivy Bridge is going to really make a dent in anything, but maybe by the time we get into Haswell, all the major vendors, Microsoft and Adobe and all those guys will really kind of take a liking to it. So that kind of sums up Ivy Bridge on the desktop, man. It's a good part. It has questions, but overall, like you said, in my conclusion of the story, it's like if I were building a new system today, I would build it around this, you know, Z77, and go from there.
We'll be talking about the Z77 in a second, but we should probably talk about the other big part of the Ivy Bridge release today, which is the Core i7-3720QM, the Ivy Bridge for mobile review up on PC per, quote, monster kill, unquote. And it's really interesting. Matt Smith worked this one up. It's really interesting when you start looking at this part because it's a new process. It's the Tri-Gate transistors we heard about last year that were so just a radical change in transistor architecture, which means they've got some pretty massive changes going on at the foundry. And Matt was actually, monster kill is his polite way of saying that they really hit this one out of the park. And he was, you know, he's expecting maybe 10% performance, but this one's doing fantastic on the benchmarks. You know, partially, of course, because it's the Core i7-3720QM, which is their top-of-the-line quad-core processor, which, oddly enough, is what we expect to see. Basically, the quad cores are coming out, I want to say the beginning of May, and then they'll be rolling out the more, mid-price range dual-core CPUs later on this summer. AC4000 integrated graphics again, and all the benchmarks in this were run for an Asus N56 VM. So there's some caveats when you look at the review on this one, because if you're hoping for a massive change in battery life, because we've been talking a lot about how the CPUs have a reduced power consumption, one, this is a big, heavy performance notebook. Two, it doesn't have the performance optimization software that Asus usually uses. And three, this is a big honking performance chip and a big honking performance notebook. 8 gigabytes DDR3, a 750 gigabytes 5400 RPM drive, a 15.6-inch flat panel, and a 6-cell lithium-ion battery, which is not what you would call a massive battery in a notebook.
No.
But it's, you are getting the advantages of the new architecture and the benchmarks. What was the one that grabbed me? If we go to the testing and processor performance, and I apologize to anyone playing the drinking game right now for saying do-do-do-do-do, because apparently do-do-do-do-do, that's something that forces people to do-do-do-do-do shots.
Nice. I didn't know that. Now I know.
But if you're hearing thuds around various college campuses in the United States, it was related to that. There it is. Check out the Sysoft Sandra benchmark, just to pick a completely random one. We were looking at 273.51 megapixels per second versus 155.69 on the Alienware M14X.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big difference. You're looking at processor arithmetic on Drystone, 115 GIPS versus 86.9 for the Alienware, and then getting to the sort of classic 7-zip decompression benchmarks and Windows Live Movie Maker. That's pretty crazy when you're looking at 201 seconds for your saving out an HD video versus 271 seconds for the Alienware M14X, Acer Aspire M3, 402 seconds. That's a pretty big,
it's a big difference.
Performance improvement. Alienware M14X, which is no slouch of a notebook, 75.2 seconds to convert a batch and Sunlit Batch Blitz versus 58.3 seconds for the Asus. That's healthy. That's just
One of the things I found really interesting about what Intel did with their mobile kind of reference platform, the notebooks that they sent out to reviewers, is that it included an NVIDIA discrete graphics card in it. Which was confusing, right? Because one of the big changes, the biggest change really to Ivy Bridge, is the whole graphics portion. And it's more important on the notebook, right? Where people are less likely to want to have a discrete GPU. They're less likely to have a system that has a discrete GPU. But when they sent out these ASUS systems, they actually had a Kepler GPU in them, of all things, right? So they had a fairly new, fairly up-to-date and high-performance discrete graphics card in them. And obviously we did testing with that enabled and with it disabled, so you can see the performance there. But I thought it was a little odd on Intel's part to actually include that, because it seems to me, at least, to kind of undermine their positioning in terms of HD 4000 graphics and Ivy Bridge, media architecture being enough for what anybody needs to do. It still did really good in his gaming testing, mm-hmm. I think, compared to the Kepler architecture, especially in the real-world gaming, Just Cause 2 and Battlefield 3 at medium detail. You're talking about the difference of 30 frames per second and 25 frames per second, which is not that much, right? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see. I think more people are going to be interested in the dual-core versions of Ivy Bridge. Mm-hmm. That are going to be lower power, that are going to have longer battery life, but still have the full HD 4000 performance to them. Is that something you think will be the case? I mean, quad core. If ASUS can get me a 14-inch machine that uses the quad core processor, but still has extended battery life, right? Maybe once they've tweaked their battery software and they've got all the firmware and everything perfected to where they. Whether they want it, and they could do that, I'll gladly take the quad core option over the dual core. But if there is a big difference there in battery life still, then I think the dual core hyper-threaded Ivy Bridge parts are going to be more desired in the mobile field. No,
I completely agree. I think, everything, I just had a one of the big three vendors did a briefing yesterday, and I saw the back to school summer refreshes on their major notebook lines. I got another one coming up for one of the other three major PC manufacturers, at least here in the United States, coming up in about 3 weeks. And, everybody has to have a super high end, we can turn it into a gaming PC notebook that, has you know, discrete graphics, all of the options, you know, the fastest processor available. But the reality is most of their sales are right there in the middle between $500 and $1,000. And we don't live in a world yet where you can get ridiculous gaming performance for $500. And I think most people, you know, if they really want a gaming machine, they build one. And if they have the money to buy a gaming notebook, then they drop that money into the notebook. But, you know, I'm with you. Most people are going to be like 14-inch screens, 15-inch screens, taking a look at the Core 2 Duo, bigger batteries. They're going to be buying, you know, the thicker notebooks. Although I think it's going to be interesting to see, based on some conversations I've had, you know, between in the last 2 weeks and then back at CES, how well the new MacBook Air competitors on the PC side do, because that's a big thing that's being pushed. It's like Core i7 quad core processors in ultra thin notebooks. Like an ultrabook with a quad core processor is a really interesting concept. Also kind of gets you wondering, you know, how hot that thing's going to get, even with the reduced thermal envelope, and what the battery life's going to be like. How much battery can they stuff inside of an ultrabook? Because, you know, you're looking, even at these notebooks, you're looking at like 6 hours for the maximum on the benchmark tests. And it's amazing to realize how many notebooks are out right now where they're looking at 8 to 10 hours of battery life. And that being, you know,
hopefully
desirable.
More soon.
Yeah, that would be really nice. And it's also, I mean, one thing to look at, if you're looking at the battery test, you know, there's a pretty radical difference between like the Peacekeeper battery test, the battery eater readers test, and the battery eater standard, where you're looking at blowing through a battery in 1 hour and 8 minutes with the battery eater standard versus like 4, almost 5 hours on the readers test. And that's a, you know, basically, if you're doing a, you know, if you're rendering out video, your battery life is going to suck. You know, if you're watching a DVD on
almost
a plane,
every instance, yes. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, and that's just the nature of computing. When you ramp everything up and turn the brightness up on the monitor, guess what? Your battery life goes down a hole. So I think it's really interesting to watch the notebook vendors start to really push these, what also is coming out, these 14 and 15 inch ultrabooks that are coming this summer, mostly 15 inch. Like I said, I think it's going to be like 13 inch and 15 inch for ultrabooks in a big way going into this fall and into the Christmas shopping season. And I'm really curious to see what the battery life is like with the new Ivy Bridge processors.
Just a couple of other quick things to mention on the desktop side of things. We posted a couple of stories on the JJ from ASUS actually came out to the offices there in Kentucky and showed off a bunch of their Z77 motherboards, like basically all of them that are available today. Everything from the basic P8 Z77V to the Pro, the Deluxe, into the Mini ITX, the Micro ATX, the Sabertooth, the Gene, the Formula, the ROG boards. And he also showed some overclocking demonstrations using the UEFI as well as the in-Windows software, demoed things like WiDi working on a desktop machine, which is, you know, it's not even an ASUS only feature. It's just you don't really think about it, right? If you've got an Intel wireless chip in your desktop machine, you can absolutely do wireless display technology, which is pretty cool when you're talking about a home theater PC again, right? Mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting stuff. We showed and demoed Fan Expert 2. We demoed USB 3.0 Boost, which is the ability to overclock the USB 3 bus, essentially, which is actually pretty cool. And it changes it in from a bot mode to a iSCSI mode in the Windows interface, which is actually pretty interesting. They also demoed Wi-Fi Go, which is kind of like an ASUS exclusive remote desktop inside your house on your phone versus on another computer, DLNA streaming and that kind of stuff, which is pretty cool. So if you want to check out those videos, go ahead and do that. They're pretty interesting. And then also, if you are interested in overclocking, they did end up using LN2 on a P8 Z77 board to hit 7 gigahertz with an Ivy Bridge Core i7 3770K. So that whole thing I said, talking about processors extreme overclocking not as great.
So what you're saying is, you know, if you've got a DOR of liquid nitrogen and a little bit of patience, the Ivy Bridge processors will be fairly friendly to ridiculous levels of overclocking.
Yes. That's definitely the case. I am not one of those people. I'm interested in it when I'm around guys that are doing that at events. I think it's pretty cool to sit there and watch and learn about. Right. But I don't tend to stock that at the office.
That's reasonably understandable. Interesting note from Digitimes by way of not to step away from Ivy Bridge for a moment, but to step away from Ivy Bridge for a moment.
Yes, let's do it.
CNET basically read an article on Digitimes that says an SSD price war is on the way or perhaps overdue. The Digitimes article, if you click on the sort of giant Digitimes in the link on the rundown, Brian, SSD vendors set to trigger price war to force out smaller peers. And it's interesting. So basically the classic Digitimes industry sources in Taiwan, quote, a number of channel retailers, which usually sell commodity memory products, including flash drives and memory cards, recently began to offer SSDs. And the big SSD producers aren't really happy about that. So what the article is saying is that Kingston, Intel, OCC, and Crucials are dropping their SSD prices to make sure these smaller flash memory manufacturers can't get a good solid toehold in the market at the low end. So
totally fine with that.
Yeah, you know, there's part of me that doesn't want to argue with that at all, but, you know, it's fun. In addition, quote, SSD vendors hope to speed up the industry transition from SATA 2 to SATA 3 by narrowing the price gap between the two product segments. SATA 3 SSDs are only $10 higher than SATA 2 SSDs right now. And, quote, I thought this would make you laugh. The availability of SATA 3 has been identified as a new demand driver for SSDs in 2012. And I was like, really? I didn't know that. Like, we're all going to upgrade to SATA 3 drives once the price drops. You know what I mean? It's an interesting thought. Like, you know, I think once you've eaten the $200, you know, actually, you can almost pick up an SSD for $100 if you don't mind a fairly small one and a fairly early one, do your price poaching on Newegg or Amazon. But the thing I like the most about this is like the mainstream capacity is going to jump to 128 and 256 gigabytes. So that will be like the entry level on notebooks or high-end desktops if you're buying them from a vendor. And that is a thought that makes me really, really happy that the idea that instead of, you know, getting a 64 gigabyte drive and the price of a notebook, you'll get 128 or 256. That would make me happy.
Yes, I agree.
The thing that makes me happy.
I was just going to say, you had a story in here that I had not seen yet about running the GTX 680 on an open source driver. Now, I did read this. So was it successful? It's actually kind of surprising if it is successful kind of this early in the game, even though you still can't buy a GTX 680.
Yeah, well, I thought it was I thought that's one of the questions we got this week. It's like, why can't I find a 680? And it's like, well, because the channel's empty and nobody can find one for sale. So go knock on, you know, I'll head down the peninsula and I'll go kick on the front door at NVIDIA and ask them what's going on. But this was up, I found this on HardOCP, posted this, and it's a really interesting concept. It's like, the opening of the article on Phoronix.com, thanks to clean room reverse engineering, it is already possible to run the NVIDIA GeForce GTX 680 Kepler GPU on a fully open source graphics driver, complete with OpenGL acceleration. And they're posting the first benchmark of this, quote, work in progress, community created open source GeForce 600 series graphics driver, unquote. And of course, all open source drivers are really sort of community, for the most part, community created and works in process. But I guess they managed, the Nouveau project actually managed to get the GTX 680 on launch day and start reverse engineering the NVIDIA driver, which they point out is closed to source in order to write an open source alternative. So they literally, like, just before launch, a couple of the developers got a hold of the cards and started hammering on them from literally the day the 680 shipped to the lucky few people who got a hold of one to start doing the driver changes. And they found, apparently, they got, like, literally, like, the initial driver running the day that the card came out, because the GeForce 400, 500 Fermi chips were close enough. The drivers were close enough between that and the Kepler series, the 600 series. So if you are an open source geek and you want to get your happy on, check out Phoronix.com and look for running the NVIDIA GeForce GTX 680 on an open source driver. which may be the most literal title I have read in at least a month.
Didn't seem like to put a lot of creativity into that, but it should be great for search engine optimization. So
yeah, I was going to say, welcome to the world of SEO. Clever is bad, blunt is good. And AMD actually just released their Catalyst 12.4 drivers. So Windows XP, Vista, Windows 7, Linux. If you're a little into the closed source, Windows XP support for the Radeon HD7900 series. This is another hard OCP article. Super sampling, anti-aliasing, detail image quality enhancements. Pardon while I sneeze. Morphological anti-aliasing, quote, significant performance enhancements, which are basically the 7900, the 7800, 7700, the 6000, 5000 series, quote, up to 80% faster than on previous versions for morphological anti-aliasing, and texture filtering quality improvements, basically for
that's
the 7800 and 7700 series. So AMD keeping it real with the driver upgrades. Mostly, though, the big deal there is Windows XP.
Yeah. Well, Windows XP, if you still got it and you buy 7900 series graphics cards, that's good to know, I guess.
I'm not going to fix it.
Well, that's fair. Let's go ahead and thank today's the podcast sponsor. We're running a little bit behind. We had a lot of Ivy Bridge discussion, but we wanted to make sure we mentioned to everybody our favorite sponsor. Netflix. And our most frequent sponsor is Netflix. That's right. You see, it's not a surprise to anybody anymore. If you're listening to the show, you know what Netflix is, and we're just trying to convince those last handfuls of people to sign up and try the service. Netflix allows you to stream thousands of TVs and movies directly to you instantly, no matter where you are, as long as you have an internet connection. You save time, money, and hassle. You don't have to worry about going to a rental store. You don't have to worry about returning anything when you're done with it. When you're done watching the movie, you just turn off that device and you're finished, right? You have no more obligations to the service. There are lots of ways to access Netflix. Obviously, you can watch on your Mac or your PC. That's the most obvious way. It's where it started. You can use the iPad, iPhone, Android phones support the Netflix app. A lot of Android phones do now. Now, if you want to watch it on your TV, which I think most people will be interested in doing, there's lots of ways to do that, too. You can use a game console like a 360 or a PlayStation 3, even a Nintendo Wii. Those all have options for that. If you have a Roku device, if you have an Apple TV, those all have the Netflix streaming capability. And TVs and DVD players and Blu-ray players, a lot of them already have support for these devices in there. If we're looking at the list here, we've got Sony and who else have we got? LG, Samsung, Sony, Insignia, Philips, Panasonic, internet-connected Blu-ray players, internet-connected HD televisions. And TiVo. You can do it through TiVo now, too. So there's all kinds of ways to access Netflix. You definitely want to give this a shot. One of the best features is, besides the capability to just watch anything wherever you're at, is that it's smart enough to let you finish stuff wherever you happen to go. So if you watch a show, you're watching an episode of something, or you're watching a movie at night, you turn it off because you're tired, you got to go to sleep. You can finish it on your phone or your tablet on the bus ride to work the next morning, and it picks up from where you left off. It's really, really cool. You can watch as many shows as you want, as often as you want. There's no limit to that service, which is really great. And we want you to try it free for 30 days. All you have to do is go to netflix.com/twit to get your free 30-day trial. We really appreciate it if you use that URL. It helps us, helps them, helps everybody. We get to continue bringing you the show. So netflix.com/twit, 30-day free trial. Give it a shot, and we'll think you'll be impressed. So we thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and the entire Twit networking community.
Woo-hoo. Let's fire up the viewer questions. If you'd like to send us a question, we'd love to have it. It's twitch@twit.tv is the best way to get a hold of us via email, twich@twit.tv, or you can Twitter us at Ryan Shroud or at Patrick Norton. I've got a great question from Denise, who wants to see the Velociraptor faced off against the Momentus. Hi, Ryan and Patrick. I was watching episode 166 on the WD Velociraptor drives versus SSDs. What about Seagate's Momentus XT 750 gigabyte versus the WD Velociraptor? Which drive would be faster overall? Which one would you buy? Thanks for all the great info. Denise, on the island of Martha's Vineyard. It's a beautiful part of the East Coast, and I wouldn't mind being there right now. I am trapped inside of an office, and you are on an island full of fun. Man, WD Velociraptor's really cool. It's really fun. I would buy the Seagate Momentus XD before I'd buy it, probably, which may not be the most rational decision. But I would, you know, first choice SSD with a secondary, a large secondary hard drive. Second choice, I'm really on the Seagate Momentus XT bandwagon.
See, I would tend to agree with you just personally. But Alan, this may be a bias from our storage guy at PC Perspective, Alan, where he doesn't want people to be on that bandwagon. He would either rather you be on a standard drive or on an SSD. And he kind of considers the Momentus solution to be mediocre, mostly because of the size of the cache on the drives.
Right.
Once they increase that, I'm thinking he'll change his mind because he did like the Intel SRT technology, which is essentially the same thing that the Momentus XT does, just on a smaller scale on hardware, as opposed to through a RAID controller or anything like that. Which one would be faster overall? It really depends on so many different things. Like, if all the stuff you want to do can fit inside the SSD cache on the Momentus XT, the Momentus XT is going to be faster. If you only use a couple of applications on a daily basis, then you'll probably see a performance benefit with the Momentus XT. If you use really large applications, you use varying applications and workloads, then it's not going to be able to store all that in the SSD cache on the XT drive. So you may see performance benefits from the Velociraptor. You know, the best answer is obviously SSD and storage drive, but for people who don't have that capability, they don't have the cost or the ability to install more than one or two hard drives in their system, then you have to make your trade-off there.
There you have it. Mirror Torrent writes in. Actually, you want to do the all-in-one question or the
sure.
desktop server question?
Let's do the all-in-one here. It says, thanks for the very informative show for the hardware geeks. I have two questions. The all-in-one desktops like the HP TouchSmart series features multi-touch. Do you think it is okay to buy one right now or wait until it ships with Windows 8 installed? And the second question, some of the TouchSmart can be customized with the discrete Radeon 6550A graphics card. It's not a desktop or laptop class card. What graphics card could it be comparable to? So, Patrick, you want to take this? Would you buy an all-in-one now, or would you be waiting for Windows 8?
I would be really tempted to wait for Windows 8 just because it's going to be. I've used Windows 7 on a Touch Smart. I like the hardware for the Touch Smart. It's kind of really neat when you're playing around with multi-touch on the screen. But I find HP's. You're either going to really love HP's software they bundle with it, or it's going to drive you insane. And what I've been trying to find out, if anybody's done a really good review of the Windows 8 pre-releases running on an HP Touch Smart. And some people did have some difficulties installing, like the developer's preview. But the developer's preview was so early and so, I will affectionately say, incomplete. I wouldn't really judge it on that.
Okay.
You know, for simplicity's sake, like, you know, you're talking about a few months. It's interesting because the rumors that are coming out right now is that there's going to be a release candidate Microsoft's got another cool fancy marketing name for it, but what's essentially like RC1, release candidate 1, coming out sometime in the next couple of weeks, and then we'll be getting hot and heavy with... Pardon me? Figured I'd try to blow my nose before I sneezed into my microphone. Is going to have RC1 coming out, and then... pretty fast, I want to say September or October for a release on Windows 8, which, you know, of course, this is rumor mongering. If you need a computer now, I'd say, yeah, go ahead and get the Touch Smart. It should have everything it needs to competently run Windows 8. I don't think you're going to have a problem there. I think the $64,000 question is going to be, you know, driver support installation. Do you want to buy a computer, have it for 3 months, and then have to pick up a brand new operating system? Pay for a new operating system, install it, and reconfigure it. You know what I mean? If that doesn't bother you, go ahead and buy it now. It can be really nice to actually have the device ship with all the drivers in place so you're not hunting them down. On the flip side, HP is pretty good about writing drivers, so I wouldn't sweat that too much. The second part of the question, the 655A.
So I just looked that up, and that is actually basically equivalent to a Radeon HD 6570 discrete card is running slightly lower clocks, but it does have 480 stream processors. So it is equivalent to a 6570, I guess, to just, right. just flat out answer his question there. I don't know, depending on what it is you're doing on this Touch Smart machine, if it's worth adding it into there. If you're going to do any kind of gaming, it might be worth it. I don't know what the specs of the Touch Smart he's particularly looking at, but that's if you wanted to know what it's closest to, that's what it is.
Based on, it's kind of funny, there's a lot of, HP's offering some pretty extensive customization through their website, but based on the discrete graphics options, it's probably a 520 XT, which means you can get anywhere from a Core i5-2400S to a Core i7-2600S processor. 4 8 gigabytes of RAM, you know, standard or solid state drive. And it's kind of funny, you can basically get a NVIDIA GeForce 520M, a Radeon HD 6550A, 7450A, or an NVIDIA GeForce GT 540M. So there's kind of a crazy array of processor GPUs available for that one. Yeah, if you're not going to game, is there any point to actually getting one of the faster GPUs? I would also say, gosh, you know, Ivy Bridge is shipping. There's the major summer computer, you know, switchover. And, you know, I wouldn't entirely be surprised if there's going to be some updates, some refreshes to all-in-one PCs with the launch of Windows 8. So let me change my answer before. I'd wait.
I think I would as well. I think, yeah, for something as kind of... no pun intended, touchy, wishy-washy is like the touch interface on Windows machines. I think I would probably wait, see what Windows 8 does. And if the hardware, I think all the hardware vendors are going to have unique refreshes at that time too. So we think we got time for one more question, maybe one or two.
Brian?
Yeah.
One more? Two more?
Yeah.
You want to do desktop home server or iPad heat issues or?
Let's do the desktop home server. Let's do that one.
Okay. Got an interesting question from MirrorTorrent, who writes in, can my desktop be my home server? Hello, Patrick and Ryan. I'm planning a build for Mepis Linux or Mint 13 based off the high-end leaderboard specs with some edits like a smaller SSD, multiple hard drives, and an unused EVEA NVIDIA 9800 GTX. I have many questions for this build, but to start, one, do you see any incompatibility between Intel Core i7-2600K and the 9800 GTX? Two, is it worth it for me to use this card at all? My thought is no. Three, if that is not enough, I would like to put this desktop up for Wi-Fi and have it for a RAID 5 server, streaming music, editing videos, photos, and maybe even Blender. So my third question is, how much can one box do? For one box, it can do it all. Can a desktop and server be one? Keep up the great show, and thank you, MirrorTorrent. Boy.
Don't use the 9800.
Yeah, I think we agree on that.
I mean, it's not worth it. For any of these purposes. So, I mean, it's not going to be useful in terms of streaming anything.
Right.
And if it's going to be a home server, eh.
Yeah. you know, I mean, at this point, you know, it's kind of like, can you run your home server off of your desktop? Yeah. I mean, if you're building if you've got like a, you know, Core i7 or, you know, Core i5, one of the new Ivy Bridge processors, you know, and you're talking about basically like streaming videos to a set top box or your Blu-ray player. Yeah, you'd actually be surprised. The vast majority of stuff we do on computers don't tap into much of the cores. It's only when we start really hammering on them with, gaming, serious video editing, ripping Blu-rays, when you're ripping Blu-rays across five drives, ripping and encoding, I should say, Blu-rays across five drives simultaneously, that you even really start to tap into how much work the CPU can do. I would basically start, build the machine, use the integrated graphics. You know, the RAID 5 server kind of gets to be a pain. You could create a RAID 5 internally, but then you end up sucking a lot of heat, generating a lot of heat, and pulling a lot of power inside the case. I would almost say, you know, I would suggest getting a NAS box for storage. Also, just in case you do something really silly, there's nothing more embarrassing than accidentally wiping out your RAID configuration that, like, your wife has her thesis stored on. You know, I think if you're talking about having, when as soon as you say RAID to me, you're like, I want redundant, you know, redundancy. I want everything to be safe. If a disk fails, that to me says get it outside of your PC, whether you're running Linux or OS 10 or Windows. You know, if you're like, hey, I want to be able to stream movies and the music collection from the server, you know, host that stuff on the Linux box and share it with everybody, because I don't think you're gonna have any problems. You know, Blender gets really interesting because it's a 3D application. But you know, my thought is build the machine, try setting up the services you want to set up in terms of sharing them off of the Linux box. And if it turns out to cramp your style in terms of CPU performance, then build a second box or buy a dedicated NAS box and start serving and storing that data off.
But I really don't think we'll have to do that. I just, you know, he's talking about using Blender and that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, here's somebody who's actually going to use all the processing power that a Sandy Bridge or an Ivy Bridge processor actually provides. So I say go for it. You can always add a little, like he's saying, you can always add a little streaming box later if you want to. But I think you'll be fine.
There we have it. We have run out of time for this episode of Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. What's coming up on PC Burr this week? More Ivy Bridge, sir?
So we're going to do some more Ivy Bridge testing for sure. We have a lot of Z77 motherboards to get through as well. Kind of talk about the feature sets on all these. Maybe do a little more research on what overclocked memory speeds mean for Ivy Bridge, both in terms of graphics performance and maybe USB 3.0 integrated controller performance. And I bet this will just blow you away next week, Patrick. But we're going to have graphics cards to talk about.
The legendary
new graphics cards. Right? We didn't talk about new graphics cards all week. This whole episode, we didn't do it. So, but next week we'll make up for it.
Do we actually? That's kind of, actually no way. I think we mentioned graphics card in the context of testing Ivy Bridge.
Right.
Well, we're going to keep things pretty simple. I'm hopefully going to be over my allergies by Monday's Techzilla shoot. We're going to be talking about the Maxthon browser, which is an alternative to Chrome and Firefox and Internet Explorer on your Windows machine. Mr. Ryan Schrout, I believe, is going to, assuming his internet connection holds up, Ryan's going to be joining us to talk a little bit about Ivy Bridge.
Yep.
And we may even be lighting something on fire on Monday's episode of Techzilla. So
Techzilla
is the place to go. Well, it's always funny when you walk up with something with a hard drive inside of it and then drop it in a bucket full of water and basically set your timer to come back 2 days later. You just don't get to do that often enough in my world. On that bright and cheerful note, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.